Welcome back to the Plants and Policies podcast, everyone, where we talk about all things plants, animal agriculture, and the policies specific to the food system in Canada. With the upcoming Earth Day just around the corner on April 22nd, we thought this podcast episode should be dedicated to, well, the planet. And by the way, folks, my name is Ina Tomchescu, and I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Maddie Youngman. We both work at Canadians for Responsible Food Policy, with Maddie doing research surrounding barriers to plant-based food adoption, environmental labeling, government support to animal agriculture, and so much more. I am the managing director, which means I get to do the administrative work, the day-to-day operations, and oftentimes the marketing with the help of many of our volunteers supporting all aspects of CRFP. So, Maddie, let's get into it. What are planetary boundaries and why are they important?
Yes, so very important. If you read any scientific journals about the climate crisis or environmental destruction, you may have heard of the term planetary boundaries before. It also kind of just circulates in, I guess, our conversations, at least when we do work like this. So you may or may not have heard this term before, but for me, it essentially means maintaining a balance on our planet enough so that we can sustain life for ourselves and, of course, future generations to come. The Eat Lancet support report by Willett and colleagues in 2019 defines planetary boundaries as, quote, nine boundaries, each representing a system or process that is important for regulating and maintaining stability of the planet. They define global biospheric limits that humanity should operate within to ensure a stable and resilient Earth system, mainly meaning conditions that are necessary to foster prosperity for future generations. And they also say, quote, planetary boundaries identify and define the biophysical safe operating space for environmental systems and processes that contribute to the stability and resilience of the Earth system, end quote.
Basically, folks, have you ever heard of Earth Overshoot Day? And I'm using this to sort of simplify the things that we're talking about in terms of planetary boundaries. I'm going to read from Wikipedia. Earth Overshoot Day, or EOD, kind of sounds like end of day, but it's not. Earth Overshoot Day is the calculated illustrative calendar date on which humanity's resource consumption for the year exceeds Earth's capacity to regenerate those resources that year. The term, quote, overshoot represents the level by which human population's demand overshoots the sustainable amount of biological resources regenerated on Earth. This year's overshoot day for Canada has actually already been surpassed, which it was actually March 15th. And I was so shocked to see that because, by contrast, last year's was August 2nd, 2023. We are increasingly overusing Earth's resources at an alarming rate. So, when I think about the planetary boundaries, quote unquote boundaries, planetary boundaries, I'm essentially thinking about Earth overshoot. Can you take us a little bit into a deeper dive, Maddie, on this?
Yes, for sure. So we're going to kind of go back in time and sort of dissect where this term comes from, planetary boundaries. So planetary boundaries are important to the sustaining of life and prosperity of life through the balance of our activities on Earth and how the Earth reacts to those activities. So think of the overshoot definition you just heard. And the Earth reacts to these activities that we do on the Earth, through our daily lives, through various systems that it does to regulate the life and the conditions for life on this planet. In their 2009 article, Rockström and colleagues suggest, quote, identifying and quantifying planetary boundaries that must not be transgressed could help prevent human activities from causing unacceptable environmental change, end quote. In this article, Rockström and colleagues, who coined the term planetary boundaries, argued that, quote, these boundaries are defined by the safe operating space for humanity to respect the Earth system and are associated with the planetary biophysical subsystems and processes. Although Earth's complex systems sometimes respond smoothly to changing pressures, it's very flexible in that way. It can be very adaptive to what we do, but there are limits. They say it seems that this will prove to be an exception rather than a rule. Many subsystems of the Earth react in nonlinear and often abrupt ways and are particularly sensitive to the threshold levels of certain key variables, end quote. And they even say that, quote, crossing certain biophysical thresholds could have disastrous consequences for humanity, end quote. Also claiming that, quote, 3 of 9 interlinked planetary boundaries have already been overstepped, end quote. And this is in 2009. So imagine what it is now in 2024. How many boundaries have been overstepped since then? And, you know,
I have the answer.
Okay, well, let's hear it. Research from Ina this time.
Pointing answer. The answer that I found was that 6 of the 9 planetary boundaries have been exceeded. This is according to science.org in September 2023. I'm actually going to read out the planetary boundaries because I want to go just a little bit deeper and also just back to sort of the start, because this might actually be a new term that you've heard. So I'm going to break down the 9 planetary boundaries. I'm going to start with the ones that have actually already been crossed. First one is biosphere integrity. Second one is climate change, land system change, freshwater change, and biogeochemical flows. These have all been crossed. And by the way, the last one, I feel like some of these words are often just very big words that we'll never hear again. And a lot of us didn't go to school for these specific scientific terms or scientific studies. So I'm going to just quickly just do a definition of the biogeochemical flows. It's relating to or denoting the cycle in which chemical elements and simple substances are transferred between living systems and the environment. So those are the 6 that have been crossed: biosphere integrity, climate change, land system change, freshwater change, and biogeochemical flows. And then we have the ones that have not yet been crossed, which is ocean acidification, though we are 100% en route to that as we see more articles coming up proving ocean acidification is happening and it's actually worsening. The last two are atmosphere aerosol loading, and lastly, stratospheric depletion. Those are the 9. So yes, since 2009, 3 more have been added to the list. So there's 6 of the 9 that have already been exceeded.
That is terrifying. You know, there's only 3 left, and like, I can't even, I don't even want to think about how much longer, because it's obviously an exponential growth of destroying these planetary boundaries. So like, it's not going to be as long as 2009 to 2024 again for the next 3, you know.
No, it just keeps exponentially grows from that, and also our population is consistently growing, and it's consistently growing at an alarming rate. Like it's going from like 7 to 8 to 10 billion people in the world. Like we are way over. I think one of the other things I saw in the overshoot statistics as well is that it looks like we are now, I think it's up to 2023. We need 1.7 Earths to sustain all of the people on it and all of the demands of humanity. We're already way past what we can handle at this point. But mind you, I will say that as we continue going on through this podcast, like we do have some solutions for a lot of this stuff. So it's not, I hope it's not causing some anxiety like mid-podcast. But I think we do have some anxiety and we do see the urgent need to change. But I do want to make sure that I highlight the importance that we are able to change, and we are able to change these Earth overshoot days that I mentioned earlier, and it has happened in the past. And so we are capable of great things. But I'll get off my get off the pod or whatever it's called when you're monopolizing the conversation. And Maddie, I'll hand it back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to bring us back to the Rockstrom study in 2009, because as early as 2009, they determined that, quote, humanity may soon be approaching the boundaries for global freshwater use, change in land use, ocean acidification, and interference with the global phosphorus cycle. So their analysis also suggests that 3 of the Earth system processes, so the climate change, rate of biodiversity loss and interference with the nitrogen cycle had already been transgressed, transgressing their boundaries, which is the three that we mentioned before. And for the latter two of these, the control variables are the rate of species loss and the rate in which nitrogen is removed from the atmosphere and converted into reactive nitrogen for human use, respectively. Mm-hmm. And they say that these are rates of change that cannot continue without significantly eroding the resilience of major components of Earth's system functioning, end quote.
Mm-hmm. But why are we bringing this all up? We have previously touched on how our food choices impact the planet, especially when it comes to water use, land use, and biodiversity, and a discussion of planetary boundaries include all of those things. Within the Nature article, Options for Keeping the Food System Within Environmental Limits by Springman and colleagues, their research indicates that changes toward more plant-based diets in line with health guidelines could reduce the food system's environmental impact by up to 56%, depending on the specific dietary scenario.
Exactly. And that is really hopeful. So here's some hope, folks. that is something that I think we notice and we see and we go, okay, yes, this is something that could help us stay within our planetary boundaries. As a result, we need to remain within planetary boundaries. And Willett et al. In 2019 suggests that we need to remain within these planetary boundaries for food production to ensure a stable Earth system. These boundaries include the total global amount of cropland use, biodiversity loss, water use, greenhouse gas emissions, and nitrogen and phosphorus pollution that can be due to food production. They continue to say these boundaries for human health and food production identify the safe operating space, there again, within each food system should jointly operate to ensure that a broad set of universal human health and environmental sustainability goals are achieved, end quote. And in this study, they actually did a full life cycle analysis, which essentially kind of breaks down all of the things that I sort of listed about cropland use, biodiversity loss, water use, greenhouse gas emissions, and nitrogen and phosphorus pollution. Also certain things related to transportation. And they also looked at the health sort of implications of each place in the world. So this is a really expansive study. And I think that's why it's really great. And I use it a lot when I do research. But because they do this life cycle analysis, whereas other people in other studies sometimes leave certain things out, we can kind of get calculations that are therefore not as useful because we need to sort of see a really big picture to try to get as much, I guess, as closely detailed or as closely accurate as possible to sort of what we're doing here on the planet and like how, you know, if we know the numbers or at least an approximation of the numbers of what pollution is happening or what emissions are happening, we can then sort of combat that more strategically, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Now, Maddie, are there certain actions that we can take right here at home to stop the surpassing of these boundaries? And before I get you to answer, Maddie, I'll say that though we speak directly to individual people's actions, I think we should all be very aware of the fact that corporations and the richest folks in the world are the ones pushing this Earth's boundaries quite more than you and I might. It's why we believe so strongly in system change and therefore lobbying to change the entire system. Regardless, action starts within us. And I believe that once we change our mindset on our own, we can then tackle the big corporations and also communicate our mindset to our politicians and affect that system change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just to kind of go off of that, like, I really do believe that individual action can be very important to drive systematic changes, though they seem like sometimes individual action has no, you know, difference in what the collective does, especially when it's ruled by people who don't really have our interests in their interests. but I really do believe that individual action is important to drive systemic changes through that collective action that we all kind of as individuals can come together to really, I guess, uplift the things that we need to see. So this sort of means those of us doing our individual behaviors to combat the perpetuation of the climate crisis, I believe, can actually make a difference. But indeed, that does not eliminate the need for us to work towards systemic change and structural changes that will definitely mitigate or slow down the effects of climate change. So when I think of the things that we can do on both an individual and collective level, I think of things that are touching on our food system and how we eat, but also on our transportation and how we go about our daily lives and those sorts of things. This can mean taking public transit when you can and eating more plants when you can, of course, or as much as possible. But it also includes for pushing for policies that make it easier for folks to use public transit or to eat more plant-based.
Yeah.
And these things are so intertwined for me, and I see them working together to fulfill our individual and collective duties for change. And I'm really big on the saying that do what you can and advocate for the rest, because if, if something like eating more plants or eating plant-based more often or taking public transportation more often or at all is too hard for you to take on, then it's also hard for others to do the same. And that speaks volumes to me as a researcher and as somebody who's trying to do what I can to mitigate the climate crisis, because things can be really, really hard. And as humans, I know that we are very habitual. And so we do things most familiar and the most simplistic or easiest for us. And we do those most often. Our brains kind of operate in this like habitual, like do what I remember.
Creatures of
habit, exactly. So if we can advocate for making these switches to taking more public transit or eating more plants easier and more accessible for people to pick more often, then we can hopefully start to see the changes that we really, really desperately need to see.
That is beautiful. And I'm going to take your entire little comment there and your entire comment there. And I'm totally going to turn that into a reel so everybody hears it, because that was absolutely beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
And 100% begin to drive change on our own. We're examples of that, you and I, Maddie. I honestly do think that I've seen what you and I can do. Okay. You and I have done stuff already, just even with this podcast alone. And there's just two of us, you know, and I'm proud of that. And I think there's a lot of us who are passionate about seeing a better system. The change can be driven to either that's through the choices that we make or through advocating for a systemic change or a system change. I am biased when I say that we need more people involved in the system side of things, and that it's something that can often be demotivating when you don't see change right away. A lot of the work that we do is not instant gratification. So oftentimes we don't reap the results of our very hard work, but I know that they're there. And I can tell you that it is changing, and the system is changing, and that we are possible. Folks, I will switch over and let you know a little bit of it's learning time, okay? First of all, I want you to visit this website. It's called overshoot.footprintnetwork.org. It's a great source for you to see where the world status is within the planetary boundaries. And you can also access past overshoot days and then also some more solutions. And you'll be surprised to also see that within this footprintnetwork.org, you can actually see the solutions to it, which does also even mention eating more plant-based. Since this podcast is being released just a few days before Earth Day, let's do some learning about it. Written by the Associated Press, I wanted to kind of just tell you folks about Earth Day a little bit. It was a senator, and this I'm quoting, it was a senator from Wisconsin, Democrat Gaylord Nelson, who had the idea that would become Earth Day. Nelson had long been concerned about the environment when a massive offshore oil spill, of course, sent millions of gallons onto the Southern California coast in 1969. Nelson, after touring the spill site, had the idea of doing a national teach-in on the environment, similar to the teach-ins being held on some college campuses at the time to oppose the war in Vietnam. Similarly, I'd like to remind everyone that we've been talking about climate change from as early as 1896. According to NASA, quote, in 1896, a seminal paper by Swedish scientist Svante Arrhenius first predicted that changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels could substantially alter the surface temperature through the greenhouse effect. And then in 1938, Guy Callender connected carbon dioxide increases in Earth's atmosphere to global warming. Crazy, right?
That is so interesting to me because a lot of the times we will sort of see this as like a new thing, or it's just becoming more mainstream and environmentalism is becoming larger and people are sort of seeing the real effects, when in reality they've been having for quite a while, but just certain places of the world become, as we've talked before, more susceptible to climate-related disasters. And so if you live in a particular part of the world where it wasn't really happening to you, it can sort of feel like not, legit. But other people have been experiencing it for longer, and scientists have been, raising alarms and ringing bells about this for so long, as you mentioned. And it's interesting because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change referenced that evidence of climate change only started to show up around the 1970s. Despite this existing evidence that you just mentioned existing almost a century earlier. And like I said, scientists have been warning of the dangerous effects and impacts of industrial human activities taking place since the 19th century on the global climate. And this is coming from that same NASA report. And so, after forming in 1988, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, marked the alarms and mainstream these concerns. Only then.
Only then, a little too late to end, but still not too late for us to drive that change, right? Yeah. Okay. Well, that's enough education, folks. I want to first thank you for continuing to support our podcast. We are having so much fun doing this stuff and bringing you all of this research and talking to you a little bit more honestly. And I think we're doing a pretty good job bringing so much research in a what I called it earlier. What did I say it? I said it was a digestible format, right? I want be to I've always wanted to bring attention to a lot of the research that Maddie is doing, that Howard is leading as a research lead at CRFP. And I want you folks to see the amount of work that goes behind us trying to influence policy change. We have some exciting guests coming up on the Plants and Policies podcast. I want you to stay tuned for that. Don't forget to follow, subscribe, and donate to keep us going at responsiblefoodpolicy.ca. Oh, and since I'm not repeating all of the names again, you can find us on most podcast platforms and, of course, on YouTube. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening.